Welcome to Safe Space, the ABA podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Zeman. Please be sure to listen to your two code words so that way you can get your free BACB CEUs. Joining me today, I'm really excited to dive a little bit into what Nicole Stewart, behavior analyst, does within her own practice as a behavior analyst. So please join me in welcoming Nicole. Hi, Nicole. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm so excited for you to be here. Tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you got into the field.
Sure. It's so funny. I just said to someone else, like, I got to work on my elevator pitch so that I'm doing this as quickly as possible. So I wanted to be a doctor. I've always known I wanted to work with kids. Like, long story short, I always knew I wanted to work with kids. Wanted to be a doctor. My senior year of college, I did a dual major, so biology and public health. For my public health major, I had to do an internship. And I just registered for the MCATs. And then I went and did this internship at the New England Center for Children because I happened to be at like a career fair or something. And I was like, oh, cool, like a school. That sounds cool. Like, I like kids. I want to work with kids. They said it's okay. I'll do this internship. And I was like, nope, I'm good on the MCATs. Like, my first day at New England Center, I was like, this is it. This is what I'm supposed to do. Like, I felt like I've always liked kids. I've always liked science and I've always liked teaching. And I was like, oh, I could do, it's not teaching or, you know, like when you're a kid, it's like, I'm going to be a firefighter. I'm going to be a teacher. I'm going to be a doctor. Like, these really high level jobs. Nobody's like, I'm going to grow up to be a occupational therapist. Maybe now, but when I was a kid, no. I'm going to grow up to be a BCBA. Like, that wasn't an option. That wasn't like, people didn't think about that. So, I don't know. I got there and I was like, this makes so much sense. And this is so cool. So then I worked there after I graduated college. I interned and I extended my internship and then I worked there. I got my master's there, which for people who are looking at master's programs, finding places where you can work and get your master's is just a gift. I feel like it's really just the way that the program is so well synthesized is just such a great gift. And then I went into teaching for a little bit and I got my BCBA. And then now I'm currently doing private practice. And so about 50% of my job is working with kids who are not yet diagnosed or who probably qualify for an ADHD diagnosis or who have an ADHD diagnosis. And I'm providing low doses of ABA. And again, I kind of stumbled into most of my career progression has been a lot of stumbling in to things. So like the message to everybody who's listening, who's like not 100% sure where they're going to end up, go through the door that opens. You know, it's like, I feel like a door opened and I went through it and here I am. So I started to get people reaching out to me being like, hi, I've been told I need a behaviorist. My kid was just diagnosed with ADHD or level one autism. Are you able to work with them, 1 hour or 2 hours a week or something like that? I don't want a 20-hour a week program. I want just a couple hours. So I started working with kids 1-2 hours a week. And I started seeing so much progress from this like BCBA direct care low dose model. And so I've just continued to keep growing it. And it's like really been, for me, it's much more financially stable because it's hard. Like nobody can pay somebody privately to do 20, 30 hours a week. And for families, it's much more financially feasible and it allows me to work with more to provide my expertise to more families and work with more families and more kids in a way that supports larger, you know, their whole family unit.
Wow. That's really cool. And, you know, I come from the world of, you know, providing that higher level or that higher dosage of ABA hours where you mentioned, you know, you provide a lower dosage. So knowing that you provide the lower dosage, what do your sessions look like? And tell us a little bit about like the difference between a lower dosage, like what you do versus a higher dosage, which is somebody who might work more than like 10, 20 hours a week.
Yeah, that is a great question because my sessions do look very different. My data collection looks very different. Everything is still ABA, it's still data driven. So if I'm working with a client, I am working with them maybe my average generally, I work with a client for 45 minutes a week, and then I work with their family for the remaining 15 minutes of the hour talking with the parents. And so that 45 minutes, it could look different week to week. And what I'm trying to do is like, there's a high focus on shaping behavior and that shaping process. And so if it's a child who struggles with emotional regulation, it might just start with labeling emotions or tolerating, because I have kids who like, I'll start with them and I'll be like, how are you feeling today? And they're like, good. And I'm like, okay, but like, what feeling? Like, let's pick a feeling. And they're like, so I played soccer and then I did this. And I'm like, but the feeling. And they like can't even tolerate talking about the feeling and naming an emotion. It's so aversive to so many people to just talk about the feeling. And for some kids, like, is it aversive? They don't know. They don't know how to answer. There's so many different reasons. And so it's just starting to tolerate talking about it, which is a lot of modeling, a lot of play, a lot. I have like all sorts of different games. So like I have two kids clients this afternoon. One of them, we will probably play soccer the whole time. And his goal is to start to talk to me more about challenging things and to decrease the discomfort he experiences talking about uncomfortable things or negative emotions. And so we do like would you rather cards because that gives us like talking points. And then I kind of take data on like how often he says I don't know or tries to change the subject or tries to avoid a topic. And then the other one, sometimes he answers it willingly or it's not a hard topic. He's like, oh yeah, I'd rather live on Mars than under this ocean. Great. Whatever. You know, like that's an easy topic. But those serve as non-contingent reinforcement and pairing and just like, oh, we enjoyed having that conversation together so that you want to talk to me because not every question is hard. And then we go into social situations too, of like, how would you handle this social situation? And he's more routine based. So I have to like slowly insert things. So it's like we played soccer and I did Would You Rather for my head. And then in order to introduce cards, I had to introduce like three cards in a session. And then I was like, okay, now we're going to only do the cards. And now I'm trying to introduce social situations. So like last session, I did two social situations. So like it's like a very slow shaping process to get him to now like, let's talk about these hard situations that you might face with your peers and feel good about talking about it and preserve your self-esteem. And then the other kiddo, God, what am I going to do with him? Maybe make paper airplanes. And then we shoot our paper airplanes and it lands on an emotion and we have to describe how the emotion feels in our body and something that causes us to feel that emotion and then something, how we react, like what behavior that emotion leads us to do. So he's like really connecting all of those pieces together. So it's like completely different.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's so interesting too, because when we think about like low dosage too, we might think a little bit about like talk therapy. You know, you might spend 45 minutes or an hour talking to a therapist. What's the difference between what you're doing versus what someone who does talk therapy does?
Yeah, that's a good question. I can't, talk therapy has its place, and I think it's certainly great. What's hard for children is they don't know what they don't know.
Right.
Like, they don't know. So if you're just like, talk about, and I saw this with my own son, where I would go and sit in some of his therapy sessions with a psychologist, and she'd be like, how was the weekend? And he'd be like, fine. And she'd be like, how are things with your brother? And he'd be like, fine. It's like, they only talk so much. And I think skilled talk therapists or skilled psychologists or people who social workers working with kids probably do work that looks similar to my work, where they're mixing in threads that build skills or even like conversation starters. I look at it more as like I'm selecting materials that are going to build the skills that I'm looking for you to build. So like I'm looking for you to build, that child that we're throwing our paper airplanes, I'm looking for him to build more recognition between those internal events and like more interoception of like what's happening in my body when I'm experiencing an emotion so that he can recognize that and stop himself before he like throws something at his brother. And he's saying like, oh, my heart is racing. I must be angry. When I'm angry, instead of throwing something, I can exit the room. I can run away. You know, like I could do something different. And so I'm picking activities that are specifically geared toward that. My sense of talk therapy is that it's much more child-led. And so you go where the child can go, and you might try to leverage certain things, but if it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think like, and you mentioned something that was really powerful, you know, when it comes to tolerating talking about difficult things. I know, just from my own experience, I think the reason why, at least in my world, it's a little hard to talk about difficult things is because growing up on my end, I was basically told to sort of like mask my emotions.
Yeah.
And you know, you're not allowed to feel this way because if you feel this way, then everyone else is going to feel uncomfortable. And it's like, well, wait a minute, you know, you want me to fit into your box, but you're not even willing to enter mine.
That's so
Like,
true.
that's
Yeah,
not okay.
yeah. I know it's not okay. I'm sorry. Like little Michelle needs a hug
Yeah,
because
true.
that's not a good
Yeah.
vibe to grow up with.
Yeah, it's not a good vibe to grow up with. And not only that, but it teaches the wrong kind of lesson too, you know. And that's why it's that much more important that when we are, you know, feeling a certain type of way, like we might need help, or you know, children might need help being able to identify those emotions. Children might need a little bit of help with like navigating difficult feelings. Plus two, modeling does matter, you know, when it comes to modeling. Just being able to like express your certain like your emotions and being able to see kind of how other people do it, it does help a lot more than you think too.
It really does. It really, really does. And one of the first things I tell parents to do is to just label their emotions as they're going through their day. So like you burn the eggs, say like, oh, I'm frustrated I burned dinner. Apparently I eat eggs for dinner. So spoiler there. Now everyone knows that in my house, breakfast is a 3 times a day meal. But it, you know, I feel like I do like I'm like, you need to. If your child's not talking about how they're feeling, you need to be bombarding them. That like language bombardment of like, oh, I'm so excited to see you, or like, oh, I'm so frustrated my phone just keeps buzzing, or you know, whatever. You just need to start labeling things so that they're seeing like it's normal to talk about how you feel.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and I love the fact that you're doing this type of work just because of the fact that, you know, number one, not every single family is going to be able to not only financially afford it, but commit to that time. You know, I think a lot about, you know, families that are being told, okay, you know, we're recommending 15, 20, 30, 40 hours a week. And that's a lot of hours. That's a lot of time. And, you know, it's not just a financial burden, it's a time burden. It's,
It
you know,
is.
it's a matter of like, at what point does the child get to be a child
I know.
outside?
I know. It's so true. And I feel very strongly. I think as a mom, I feel very strongly about that. And I've also seen, so like some of what's really convinced me is that I had a child in the pandemic that I saw for 30 minutes a week virtually. And he was not one of these, my kids that I'm seeing that have ADHD or, you know, or in gen ed settings, maybe have a 504. He was nonverbal and had very limited language, very limited ability to sit. And I saw him for 30 minutes once a week because that's all we could squeeze in. And his tech would observe, you know, he had like a basically like a nanny who would sit with the sessions and she would observe what I'm doing with him and then repeat it throughout the week. And he and I created a whole routine. And so he would go, like, we would sign on, he'd say hi to me, he'd ask me where my cats were, we'd do a scavenger hunt to find the cats. Like, this was a kid who had no language. And he'd be like, where's Cat? Where's Hamilton? Where's Tiger? Like, and then I'd go and I'd be like, is, and we worked on yes, no questions. Is he here? No, let's go into another room. And
Oh,
like, it just, it showed me, and not to knock, I think high levels of ABA are absolutely necessary for lots of people. And I think it takes a burden off of families. But I also think it doesn't have to be 30 hours or nothing.
yeah, absolutely. I agree with that completely, especially again, like we're looking at a child, and you know, we're looking at a lot of the clients that we work with are school age. So they're already in school, what, 25 hours a week, something like that, depending on the states. And then you've got that amount of time, and then you've got after school until bedtime. Try to throw, you know, the service into the mix of that. It's like, at what point do you get to be a kid,
I
you
know.
know?
I know. Yeah, I know. And like, I see my kids do baseball and they do the school play. And like, it is really, you lose those opportunities. And I think for kids with more profound needs, they also like the less they're exposed to those opportunities, the less they're able to participate in those opportunities. Because like, the longer you go without having those experiences, the harder it is. Like, if you suddenly said to me, like, Nicole, go play golf. Be like, I don't know how to play golf, but if you started teaching me at 6 how to play golf, I would know what, you know, it's like, so they've never been in these social settings or never done any of these things because they're so consumed by everything else they're doing or their therapy sessions, then, you know, it doesn't allow for them those experiences as well, which is part of being a kid.
Absolutely,
Yeah.
absolutely. And that being said, too, it makes me wonder, you know. What do parents tell you about their experiences with traditional therapy before finding your approach?
Yeah, so I get a lot of parents who come to me. I think there's two things that parents tend to try at first. It's traditional talk therapy, they find, or play therapy. They find somebody who's a talk therapist or a play-based therapist, and they say, you know, it was great, or my kid really liked them, but I didn't see any changes, or I didn't know what to do, and it wasn't really helpful. Because they find that there's not a lot of like actionable pieces. And I think that that's where my parent support comes in, is that like, I'm not just working with the child. And some people do this, like they also work with the families too. But on a whole, in my area, not a lot of people are working with the child and the family. I find a lot of like, there's parent coaches who are helping the parents, and there's therapists who are helping the child. And there's not a lot of that carryover of like, how do we make this like a functional family unit? So that we're carrying over a lot of the language that we're talking about in the sessions and like the strategies we talk about in the sessions, so that the parents then can use similar language, can use those strategies, and like, I'm taking my expertise of how I've learned how your child's brain works to say like, hey, your kid actually needs like 20 seconds of processing time. So I know you feel like they're not following a direction, but can you count to 20 before you repeat it? And like, see, do they make any moves to show that they understand you? Because it actually takes them longer to disengage from what they're doing or whatever. And like, I'll learn those things and help them with their child. So I often find like parents, they tend to stagnate in different types of therapy. And I've recommended kids for other therapies as well. But where I find the breakdown is that parents don't see the therapeutic work translating to home. And especially with like behavioral regulation. And then when it comes to regulation, the other therapy I see most commonly tried is occupational therapy. And I have also recommended kids for occupational therapy, where I say like, their sensory systems are completely out of whack. I can't even begin to teach them emotional regulation because they're not understanding how their body is like moving in space or operate, like they're not regulated. Your child is dysregulated, and so they need to learn to what their body needs to be regulated before they can even start to understand what it's like when it is dysregulated. But oftentimes, like, people think occupational therapy is going to address like behavioral meltdowns and things like that. And I get a lot of occupational therapists who are like, it's a behavioral problem, not a sensory problem. And then you get like talk therapists who are like, it's a sensory problem, not a behavior problem. And so like, I'm somewhere in the middle of that, where it's like, it's both. And what environmental modifications and what antecedent strategies and what skills can we bolster in to help support this child's sensory issues and their behavioral needs?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I've heard that too, where it's like, you know, oh, it's a behavior problem, but you know, it might not actually be a behavior problem. It might be something a little bit more. And, you know, we might sit here and say like, ABA is considered the quote unquote gold standard, but that's the problem. Like, we're not the only therapy out there. You know, we have a variety of other options that are out there too, that are just as good and might even be a better match for a child.
It's really about the match. Like, I feel like that match word is such a good one, because I, again, I don't want to knock any other therapist, because I've also worked with people. I will also send kids. My own son goes to a social worker. I will send kids to and say, like, I think your child would benefit more from occupational therapy or speech therapy or talk therapy or play therapy or, you know, EMDR, whatever.
Yeah.
But I just find the families who find success with me have often tried other things that are not the right match, because there's that bridge of, you need to have that bridge of what's happening in the therapeutic sessions coming over to what's happening in the home, especially with kids who have like severe tantrums or aggression or severe emotional dysregulation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you've mentioned feeling like ADHD often gets lumped in with other things too. Can you unpack what that means and why that matters?
Yeah, I mean, I think ADHD is a tricky one, I think, for a lot of people, because my son said this so well the other day. He's like, because my son, well, probably both my children have ADHD, but my older son is actually diagnosed with it. And my younger son, we just acknowledged that's probably how his brain works. And he said that oftentimes people feel that he's making a choice. And he's like, I'm not making a choice. I'm not choosing to like have to move my legs around, or he's like, it's happening and I can like work really hard to stop it, but sometimes I can't work really hard to stop it. And so I don't know, I think ADHD is like a very, it often gets, I think it like, it feels like if we can just like change those behavioral habits, we can help, we can help the child man like do better. Like, oh, if we can get you to stop, like things will do, you know, you'll do better. But actually, like, you know, that's not accepting. And it's like, it's teaching them how to mask rather than how to understand, like, oh, my mouth is going to need stimulation, but oh, I'm in a quiet area, so I'm going to hold it in here. Or like, I'm going to ask to take a walk, or I'm going to chew some gum or put some music in or whatever, so I'm not disruptive. And I think that it gets, I think, as opposed to like profound autism, which is maybe a little bit more visible, but has its own challenges. People, you know, kids with ADHD, it's like an often invisible.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I mean, I know personally with the level of autism that I currently, I guess, have, I don't know if that's like the correct verbiage here. When I was diagnosed, I was considered borderline severe. But, you know, with a lot of therapy and a lot of help, I've been able to sort of like, you know, do a lot more things. And sometimes I can understand it, because I've had to mask some of my own things, some of my own behaviors. And it's to the point where people have said, well, you don't seem like you have autism. You don't seem like, you don't look like you have autism. You don't show the signs that you have autism. It's like, first of all, that's rude. And second of all, like, you don't know what's going on in my head. You don't know my body. You don't know, like, just to give you an example, I'm currently 8 reauthorizations deep right now. And let me tell you something. I am going a little mad, and no one can see it because, you know, I'm working remote, hybrid for the most part. And I'm like, I have to control it. And if I don't control it, you know, that turns into a really bad situation. So it's like, yeah, I completely understand like this level of like invisibility that it feels. And, you know, people having to mask because of that, it's the worst feeling. It is the worst feeling.
Yeah, I'm so sorry. I feel like that's so hard for you. It's like, I agree with you. And I think like my son would be like, yes, I get it. I understand you. Cause he's like, nobody knows what's happening in my own head. And what you're doing to manage it all. And I think like a lot of times I think what's hard is we're behavior analysts. So a lot of times the work you do to manage it all then comes out as interfering behavior. But it's like, if you were holding something together for that long too, you would also have interfering behavior. So it's really more about like, how do you learn when to hold yourself together versus when to let it all out, and how to let it all out, and then how to like give yourself the supports you need to be successful, which like, I don't know. I feel like a lot of my work is really to preserve kids' self-esteem so that when they get older, they're less at risk, especially in the ADHD population, and the autism population, but I guess I'm thinking different from the neurotypical population. They're less at risk of like drug use or risky behavior or opposite, you know, DMDD as opposed to now oppositional defiant disorder. Like now we're talking about like conduct disorder. Like, you know, how do we help prevent that from escalating because they were in a hostile environment or because they were in an environment where they like are now burnt out and fatigued of masking and holding it together all the time.
100%, 100%. I really appreciate you bringing this to light, because this is something that a lot of our population really does deal with. A lot of autistic burnout, a lot of just overstimulation, and it's sometimes like even overstimulation can contribute to why we don't necessarily express ourselves. Like for example, I think it's called decision paralysis or something, or post paralysis. Yeah. Like I know if I get asked, oh, hey, what do you want to eat for dinner tonight? It's 11:37 right now, just for reference, 11:37 a.m. And I get asked, oh, what do you want for dinner? I'm like, what? I'm like, I don't know what I want. I don't know.
Yeah. You're like, it's not dinner time. I got to decide. I got to see what my mouth wants then.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And it's like, wait a minute. Like I'm supposed to make this choice. Well, I need you to make this choice so I can unfreeze, you know, whatever's in the freezer. I'm like, I can't tell you what I want at 8:30 or 7:30 at night when my brain is just processing the fact that it is 11:37 in the morning.
Yeah, I struggle with that with clothes. Like when you go to a store and all the winter stuff is out in the summer, I'm like, I'm not ready for that season. Like why? I just figured out that it's summer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Ugh, I swear.
Yeah. I do appreciate you talking about your own experience too, because I feel like it is helpful. It's like the more, and again, it's like the more we can talk about it, the more other people feel safe to talk about these things. And I just think kids don't see that enough, and they're starting to. I think this generation is much different than how I was raised. But it's still, you know, they still need a lot of modeling and a lot of, you know, seeing like, oh, you shared that and nobody thinks less of you, or nobody alienated you, or nobody said any, you know, and it was okay. It was okay. Yeah. You said that and it was okay.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that when, and it's so funny because, you know, growing up, I was told that I really couldn't express that, and that if I did, then it was going to make me look weird. But you know what? The fact of the matter is we need to be able to express ourselves in order to get what we want and need in life. Mm-hmm. You know,
that's so true.
And you know, we're in this era of behavior analysis where self-advocacy and, you know, assent and trauma assumed practices are really like the big talk.
Mm-hmm.
And even though this should have been promoted a very long time ago, you know, in the very beginning when everything happens with ABA, you know, I think, again, we really need to kind of undo that work and just really go in and really model that, you know, especially a lot of students pick up on behaviors just by watching and kind of like observing their own and observing others. And if we model that, and if we show that, hey, it's okay to be vulnerable, it's okay to put out there exactly how we're feeling, you know, whether it be through a talk therapy session, whether it be through a low dose model or a high dose model,
that should be the
norm.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I'm like all for modeling. I feel like I'm constantly talking, even because I still do work with kids during the day who may have more profound needs, who have, particularly kids who have like rare genetic disorders or multiple diagnoses. And I think that that's also where, how I was able to slide into ADHD as well, because my training has been a lot more looking at like, well, what is, as opposed to like, okay, you have autism and you don't know this skill, let me apply discrete trial training to teach you this skill or something. My training was much more holistic of like, let's take all of these environmental factors and kind of like put it into a formula and then spit out like what needs to change, you know, what needs to change if you aren't able to hold a pencil, what are we doing instead of holding a pencil to help you learn how to write or type your name or like express yourself in some way. And so I think God, I lost my train. The train's gone. It left without me.
Oh my Oh my gosh.
That. So I work with these more profound kids. Oh, I'm constantly, these might be kids who are nonverbal. I'm constantly talking to them and saying like, oh, we're going through the here, we're gonna go here, I'm gonna look for this and I'm gonna look for that. Because I just think more is more. You know, you need the more you model, even if it doesn't come out that day or the next day, I have found it comes out. You know, the more modeling, you do see faster rates of skill acquisition. You do see kids demonstrate these behaviors and pick up on them when you're constantly modeling and showing them what different things could look like.
I could not agree more. I absolutely could not agree more. Well, I want to go ahead and drop our first code word of the podcast, and that code word is emotions. That is EMOTIONS. That is the word emotions. So one of the things that you talked a little bit about within the model that you provide behavior analysis, you have the 45 minutes of the time with the child or the client, and then 15 minutes with the parents. I wanted to ask a little bit about on the parent side, when we previously spoke, you mentioned giving parents a shared language. Why is that so important when it comes to supporting our population?
You know, I think that neurodivergent individuals are more, first, often that there's like a more creative thinking. But then there's also sometimes things start in black and white when we're learning new concepts. And then you have to start to fill in the shades of gray. And I find that those shades of gray, like a lot of the kids I work with, if you give them a rule and you say, like, okay, you can't have screens past, I'm trying to think of like a good example. I'm like, what would my kids try to negotiate? You can only have screens on the weekends. And then it's a Monday and it's a holiday. So it's a 3-day weekend. They're like, well, we're saying it's a 3-day weekend. Does that mean I can have screens today or not? And there's whether they're trying to like game the system or they don't understand, you know, they're not applying the rule in this like fluid way. I feel like giving that shared language starts to build those shades of gray where like, you know, for instance, I have a lot of kids that I'll work on like red and green choices or red and green behavior to make it this concrete thing. And so parents can say like, look, that was a red behavior and this is what happened. And so like the kid can more concretely understand what that boundary was. And then once we got red and green, we started to introduce yellow, which are like sometimes behaviors. So like running on the playground is a yellow behavior because it's green when you're on the playground, but it's red when you're in the classroom. And it gives that shared language. And I think it really helps kids, especially when I find the language, because that doesn't work for every kid, but when I find the words that speak, you know, ADHD is a motivation-led brain chemistry. And so when you find the language that hits for that kid, where it makes sense for them, having the parents carry it over helps the kid feel seen and helps them say, like, whether, you know, I have another kid who we do all the zones of, it's still colors, but we do the zones of regulation. Boom. Like he'll be like, I'm in yellow. And we're all like, got it. We all know what that means. If I didn't transfer that over to the parents and he's like, I'm in yellow, parents would be like, what does that mean? What do you mean you're in yellow? Like, you know, it helps. And for whatever reason, he likes the zones of regulation. So, like, that has helped him more effectively communicate his needs.
And it's so funny because I'm hearing about or I'm listening to you talk a little bit about the zones of regulation, something that we work on as well. And I think part of that is bridging the gap between the sessions and talking to the families within the caregiver model, caregiver coaching model where it's like, okay, you know, this is some ways that we have been able to teach these specific skills. And it really just kind of sounds like when it comes to that caregiver collaboration, you know, kind of like teaching them, hey, this is a way that they've been able to describe themselves. This is what this means, you know, and kind of like really ironing out, you know, if a kid is in yellow, for example, yellow might mean certain types of emotions. And, you know, I think that just goes to show us as BCBAs and really anybody who's listening and wants to become a BCBA, that we have to take the time to go over those specific things. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we really do. We really do. And I think it also, a lot of the parents I work with want to be involved, but I also want to create a space where I'm not going to tell the parents everything I talk about with the child, everything that happens, because I want them to feel safe that, like, oh, if I'm going to, obviously mandated reporter, anything comes up that I need to report, I'm reporting it. And right. The kids know that. And I say to that, like, if you tell me something unsafe is happening, I will have to tell your parents. They know that. But, like, you know, if a kid is like, you know, I really hate that my dad does this, I'm not going to be like, so-and-so really hates that you yell at him. Like, I'm going to say, like, so we talked about it. And I, you know, I'm not going to say, like, this is what happened and this is how he felt. I'm not there to advocate for the child necessarily and, like, be their voice. But I'm there to fill in the gaps of, like, they're giving, this child is telling me that when they are feeling frustrated or they are feeling like somebody is yelling at them, they feel they are experiencing this emotion, and this is how we've labeled it, and this is what we're calling it, and this is how we've described it. When they're feeling angry or when they're feeling like they're being attacked, this is, we've given it, we went through this exercise that gave it this label or this name, this language. And so I don't have to get into the specifics. So I keep that, you know, client confidentiality and rapport that, like, I am a safe space to talk to, but I also then give it back to the parents of, like, you know, when he feels rushed, he describes his body as feeling like he can't move. And so now, like, you know, maybe in the mornings when you're rushing him, take a minute to think about how he's feeling. His body's stuck. It's in quicksand. He's stuck in quicksand.
Yeah. I definitely understand that. And I also can kind of see it from, like, the parent point of view, even though I myself am not a parent, I've never raised a child, much less an autistic or neurodivergent child. But, you know, kind of thinking about how the parent might feel when they feel like they have to rush, you know, what's the stigma that is coming down upon them that is like, oh my gosh, I really have to get them going. You know, if they don't keep moving, then they're going to be late, then they're going to get in trouble. And it's almost like this pile on of judgment. It can be a pile on of just trouble even too, depending on the situation. Like, you know, if a child is late for school, so many times they might get in trouble with the principal and they might get it, like,
or you get in trouble as the parent. Like, why is your kid not showing up to school on time? Like, why are you not able to get your kid to school on time? And it's like, well, if you saw our house in the mornings, you wouldn't ask me any more questions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's kind of like trying to get information from both, you know, from the client of, hey, you know, like, I don't like when they yell at me. I don't like how they yell at me to get ready quicker. It makes me feel unsafe or it makes me feel bad. And then it's like, well, there's this pressure of this, all of this societal pressure. And it's like trying to connect those pieces, but then trying to build empathetic communication between both the child and the client and the parent of, hey, this is how we can work together. That's kind of what I'm getting at, or kind of like interpreting, right?
Yeah. Yes. So I use a lot of, is it Ross Green or Russell Barkley? I want to, like, attribute this correctly to the correct person. I think it's Ross Green, collaborative problem solving.
Ooh.
I'm going to double check who it is.
Yeah, go for it.
Of course, it has neither name on it, but anyway, we can put it, I don't know, in your, like, show notes or something, but it's this is the Department of Psychiatry at Mass General Brigham in Boston. And it's called collaborative problem solving. I don't think that this is it's Ross Green. Okay, it's Lives in the Balance. And the whole idea is like identifying what the problem is, because oftentimes the child and the parent are looking at the problem differently. And when you look at the problem differently, you're not going to come to the same solution. And so, like, a lot of times kids are like, I don't, why do I have to go to school? Why do I have to do this? Why do I have to do that? And the parents are like, just because you have to. And when kids can understand, like, oh, why I actually have to go to school, or like, what is all of this space around that for the parent? And not to say, like, oh, the child has to be so understanding. I don't want them to be smaller, to feel smaller, like, oh, you just have to do these things. But, you know, for instance, I have a client who it's really important to the family to go to like birthday parties and socialize. And the kid was like, I just like hate it. Like, what if I don't like the cake? What if it's too noisy? What if the other kids are crazy? I don't want to go to all these birthday parties. And when he could verbalize that to me, we then came up with solutions. And so, like, that's part of it is like he was having like meltdowns, like epic meltdowns at the beginning, like going to birthday parties. And his mom's like, I don't know what to do. And then he's rude to all the kids because he's trying to get out of going. He's like, if I behave badly enough, you won't make me do these again. You won't make me go to these anymore. If I am so badly behaved, I won't have to deal with this anymore. And so mom, you know, the parents don't know how to handle that. And they're like, what do I do when he's melting down? And it's like, well, actually, like once he's melted down, that's too late. What is the problem to begin with from his point of view? So that we can like put a little modification in at the beginning so that the meltdown never happens. And it was like little things, like if you don't like the cake, we'll go buy a treat after. Like just a super simple solution. We'll come up with something. If the other kids are too noisy, we'll go sit outside. We can go sit outside. Like, and once he knew he had like solutions, he was like, okay, I guess I'll go. Like now that I know I have like exit strategies, I'll go. And so I base a lot of my work on that collaborative problem solving framework of like, how do I identify what the problem is from the child's perspective so that we don't get to the point of the meltdown?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's crucial, you know, just being able to kind of see like how we can work together and how we can also, you know, how we can also kind of put out there, okay, you know, this is a situation. This is the way that I'm feeling about this situation. And I need you to meet me halfway. You know, you don't need to like bribe me to, you know, go to this party necessarily, but I do need you to understand if I'm feeling these emotions, I need you to understand and be accommodating in that sense. I mean, just kind of thinking about my own experience, you know, I personally get a lot of anxiety from too much overstimulation, especially when it's unfamiliar people and it's like party context. So I might go into someone I know's house, but if I don't know 95% of the people, I'm gonna do one of two things. I'm gonna either cling on to the host, or the person that I'm with, or I'm just gonna leave just because it's like too much. And people, everyone needs to have that same autonomy, you know. Some people genuinely cannot handle it, and it's because, you know, of all of the unknowns. Well, what if this is the case? What if it's too loud? What if there's activity that I'm not comfortable with? What if there is, you know, what if there's like just violent, like I'm thinking about violence here for a moment. You know, what if something bad happens? You know, there's a lot of unknowns.
And I think there's a lot of my work is like, how do we meet in the middle of like, this is who your child is, and these are the values that are really important to your family. So how are we fitting those two things together? Because I think a lot of people will say, like a lot of behavior analysts will say, like, well, you know, you just have to do it this way. You just have to do it that way. And like, I've worked with families where somebody else has previously said, like, well, you can't use like, you have to use like all plastic plates. And they're like, I'm not using all plastic plates. Like, I believe plastic is bad for my family. And so my child has to learn how to use ceramic plates. And it's like, okay, but you know, your child is impulsive and might break those. So how are we teaching your child the impulse control now so that they're able to use the ceramic plates in your family, as opposed to like, we don't have to completely change the whole family dynamic because your child has autism or ADHD or whatever it may be. But how do we also acknowledge like this is who your child is and how it fits into the dynamic?
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. It sounds like that those are really good ways to like incorporate those principles of ABA and even a little bit of ACT without sticking strictly to those principles. It's kind of like, you know, because ACT, there's, you know, while I am not formally trained in ACT per se, you know, I hear a lot about flexibility, and it's like we need to have some flexibility in what we do too.
Yeah, but everybody needs to be flexible. I feel like it, like sometimes ABA feels like it's like a rigid solution for rigid thinkers. It's like, I don't know, I just feel the whole thing feels rigid. It's like you have somebody who's a rigid thinker already, and now let's teach them in a rigid way. And so I think, yeah, ACT has that flexibility, the compassion, the components that feel human. And it's like, I'm going to accept who this person is, and we're going to, you know, make a decision that we're going to figure out how it fits into this, the bigger ecosystem that they exist in.
Absolutely. I love that so much. Well, I want to go ahead and drop the second code word, and that second code word is attention. That is ATTENTION. That is the word attention. So kind of closing off, what do you wish more parents, educators, therapists, behavior analysts understood about ADHD and autism?
I think there's like a couple pieces to it because I think it's often pathologized, but I also think it's not pathologized, if that makes any, it's like a contradiction, is that it's like pathologized. Both of them can be pathologized as like there's something wrong with you, but I also think having the diagnosis, name it to tame it, exists. And I wish like the neurobiology behind why ADHD brains work the way they do is so clear. Like it's just like it's different levels of chemicals. It's different responses to different stimuli than what is studied in a neurotypical brain. And it is like the brain is like any other organ, but because there's cognition, we believe there's choice. And because there's higher level thing, like because like your kidneys don't think, they just work. You know, they just do what they're supposed to do. The brain also just does what it's supposed to do. But if your kidneys don't work properly, you take medicine and you do certain things for it, and you have a special diet for it, like you learn to manage it and you manage the way that your body works. I feel like ADHD and autism are a neuro type of how brains work, and you need to learn how to manage that and accept it, but not pathologize it as like a bad thing per se. Because I think like oftentimes the whole medical model is like designed to like lessen the symptoms of autism. And like that's not my goal here. It's not to less it's to lessen it's to like allow you to live your functional, meaningful life with the cards that you were dealt. And so I guess I wish that like more people understood that like most of what is happening is not a choice.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, the way that I've described autism from my perspective is like my brain is wired very differently from the quote unquote neurotypical brain. And so, you know, the way that I might feel, the way that I might process things, the way that I learn things, and the way that I do things is going to look very different from you, but it's still valid because it's still doing the exact same thing, just with a different process.
And you have different needs, and everybody has different needs, and that's okay. It's understanding like what your needs are and how your needs can be met in a meaningful, functional, and compassionate way for like each individual. And I guess I just, you know, I a lot of the teachers that I work with, they mean well, but they often feel like, especially the behavioral problems that kids have, they feel are within the control of the child. And especially for children with ADHD, I think when children have autism and have like the more profound communication deficits, you don't attribute it to like the child choosing to misbehave. I think when a child can behave sometimes and doesn't behave other times, you think like, oh, they're doing it on purpose, or they're just being difficult for me. And like, I always look at it like plants, like an orchid. I always describe like my ADHD kids as orchids. Like, they need highly specialized. I don't know much about plants or gardens, so like don't go to me for any of that. But like they need, you know, weeds grow anywhere. An orchid requires like specific soil and nutrients and water on a specific schedule and a specific amount of light. And like that's what these kids need. And they can thrive too. And it's, but they need the right environment and the right ingredients.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you could give one piece of advice to a parent just starting this journey with their child, what would it be?
This is probably more from my own perspective as a parent, is that I think I, well, there's, I mean, there's so many pieces of advice. I'm like, my brain is flooded with ideas.
I love it. I love
That's
it.
how my brain works. It's like so flooded. I think that they are just try to enjoy your child. I am seeing my kids' childhood disappear because they, you know, they're about to be 7 and 11. And I feel like I was so in the weeds with figuring out my son's neurobiology and like how everything works and like not trying to fix it, but he did. He's like, Mom, sometimes it felt like you were fixing me. And I think as the parent, your job is to be their landing pad. Or that's how I feel, is that my job is to be their landing pad. And so like it is not my job to, yes, I give them advice, but I often just say like, were you just venting? Or do you want my opinion? Do you want help solving this problem? Like sometimes my kids are like, I just want to tell you what was going on. I think oftentimes parents jump to try to like fix their kid and fix their problems in the way that they would. And that's not necessarily what, especially I think neurodivergent brains are looking for. I've found my son learns best from like natural consequences, to a degree. Obviously, like really extreme natural consequences are harmful to his self-esteem. But, you know, like little natural consequences are really good for him. And like rather than me telling him what to do. And I just think it's like, I wish I had spent more time just like enjoying and letting things go. Rather than being like, you had a fight with a friend, and now I need to make sure you have the social skills, and now everything's on me. And like you said, like that whole like the societal weight and all of that pressure comes down where you're just like, I have to fix this and make it better so that you have like adaptive skills to be with friends. Like, yes, and you're not going to fix it in a day. So, like, you don't need to try to cram it all in overnight so that they go to school the next day and know how to handle their friends.
Yeah, absolutely. As someone whose mom tries to fix the problem all the time, and as someone who says, I'm not asking for suggestions, I'm not asking you to fix this, I just
Oh my
want
God, that's so
to vent.
funny.
And it's so funny because, like, I'll get into like little spats and stuff with my mom. She'll be like, I'm not trying to do that. I'm like, but that's exactly how it's coming off. Like, you know, understand my perspective for about 5 minutes. So it's like, you know, it does get that push and pull, which I love that advice because honestly, you know, enjoying your child is something that everybody should be able to do, but also just really like kind of just like being there and understanding is that much more important, you know? Sometimes we do need a landing pad. Sometimes we just need a safe space. But you know, to talk to and to vent to, and sometimes we need a shoulder to cry on. And you know, we don't want you to come in with the toolbox and say, okay, what do you need fixing? We need someone to say, hey, you know what? You're safe with me. It's okay. You know, you're safe with me, and you'll always feel safe with me. So I really appreciate that advice, just coming from someone who has, which I love her very much, but I do have a mom who likes to try and fix the problem every time.
I hear you. I feel like I'm like, as a behavior analyst, I think that's how we're geared is like, oh, I see a behavior that's not happening or should be happening. Like, what intervention can I throw at it? What can I do to fix this problem? And I read Dan Siegel has a great book called The Power of Showing Up. And this is where like I pull from all these other disciplines. And it really is like sometimes just sitting there and being there with the feel with when they're having the feelings can mean more and not like inserting yourself. Like you want to be the thermostat, not the temperature. And I also find that like my kids' intense emotions feel really intense and draining for me. And then they're like we went to Puerto Rico a couple of years ago, just me and my boys. And I was like live texting one of my best friends every time something went wrong. And she's like traumatized from our Puerto Rico trip because all she heard were the hard moments that were really hard. And then I was like, it was okay, except for these hiccups. And the kids were like, greatest trip ever. It's like if you start yelling and screaming, it creates those negative memories. But if you also ride the wave of their emotion, they don't remember it as intensely as we do. They don't hold on to these things as intensely as we do. Like my kids will often be like, I wasn't that bad. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, what? Do you need the video? Do you want me to pull up a video? Do I need to start recording you doing this? But like, they just don't hold on to things. Like, we'll all yell, like, crash out in the mornings, and then I'll hold on to it, and they go to school and have a perfectly normal day.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, what beautiful advice to end on. Thank you so much, Nicole. I really appreciate all
Yeah.
your time. How can our listeners find you or contact you?
So I have my own website, Nicole. L Nicole, God, bleh. I have my own website, NicoleStewartBCBA.com. I'm also on Instagram as Mom the Behaviorist. And I guess those are the best ways to find me. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you again, Nicole. I really appreciate your time. And thank you, everybody, for tuning into today's episode of Safe Space, the ABA podcast. I've been your host, Michelle Zeman. I will see you on the next one. Bye.